Whether we consider it from a philosophical, religious, or biological point of view, there's little question that we are interconnected, and that our recognition of that moves us to take care of one another. In moments of great suffering, such as in the wake of a natural disaster, we see the human instinct to care, as people open their homes to the displaced, offer essential services to those in need, and provide funding for necessary supplies. When a situation is particularly overwhelming, this instinct can feel uncomfortable, causing us to shut down or become numb. But we always have a choice. We have the choice to cultivate a greater sense of connectivity so we can be of benefit and open to life to show up and do this kind of work, just as we have the choice to cultivate indifference, hard-heartedness, or apathy. The inherent ability we have to connect and care comes from what is called bodhicitta in Buddhism. There are an abundance of practices anyone can add to their toolkit, regardless of belief or spirituality, to help us grow bodhicitta so we can more easily make the choice to remain open to life. This episode was a fun experiment and a challenge for both me and my collaborator, Jennifer Harkness. Jen is a Dharma sister and past guest on the show, as well as a therapist. She brings her knowledge of psychology to the table to help me translate the teachings and practices of bodhicitta so that they are relatable, regardless of your practice or belief or outlook for life. Quick plug before my dialogue with Jen. If you enjoy this episode and want to hear more, you can help sustain Everything is Workable by becoming a patron or contributing a tip. Check out my website, caitlinschatch.com, to find out how. And now, on to my conversation with Jen. Hi, Jen.
Hi, Kate. How are you?
I'm excellent. How are you doing?
Pretty good.
Thank you so much for joining me in this fun episode of Taking the Leap.
Yeah, I'm excited.
So following in the footsteps of Anipema, I have prepared no notes.
Excellent.
But we do have our topic, which is bodhicitta.
Right.
When we spoke last, bodhicitta came up when we were talking about self-care. So this is a pretty big topic. And for anyone who's listening who's not familiar with Buddhism, they're like, what is this word that you were saying?
Yes.
And as a practitioner, and as someone who also just really appreciates language, I also really appreciate how there's no inherent meaning in a word. Mm-hmm. And so it's really helpful to me to be presented with a word that, is it Pali or Sanskrit? I can't remember.
I believe it's Sanskrit.
Sanskrit. Mm-hmm. Right. So being presented with a word that needs to be translated and then knowing that there isn't even a really good translation. Mm-hmm. And then on top of that, that even if I understood Sanskrit, it would still require me to do some work to understand the word.
Right.
So with that preliminary in place, I think the first thing we should do for listeners is define bodhicitta.
Right.
That indefinable word.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, it's in preparation of this this interview, of course, I was rereading definitions, but then also, you know, just been contemplating it for like 13 years. So those that you come back to over and over. But, you know, I mean, the Sanskrit is awakened mind is what it roughly translates.
Right. Bodhi being awakened, mm-hmm. and citta being mind or heart. That's
right. Exactly. And that's where I was going to go too. It's, but you know, when I first was introduced to it at Naropa, you know, we would always call it the awakened heart mind, that it's the heart and the mind coming together with prajna, which wisdom.
Yeah, another word that we can throw in there.
Right. All the words.
All the words. So the literal translation, heart, that heart-mind thing, mm-hmm. that in itself requires some unpacking. Mm-hmm. I remember the first time that I learned that Tibetans, when you ask them to point to their mind, they point to their heart mm-hmm. on their body. I remember the first time I heard that, I was like, oh my God, that makes so much sense.
Right. Right. Yeah. In the West, we like to compartmentalize a lot. So, you know, it's like, they're separate a lot. And I think, you know, I was contemplating this myself. I think when I first heard the word, like many people, I think in our culture, you know, it's a concept and I'm trying to wrap my mind around this concept. But bodhicitta to me now, years later, it's much more of an experience, and it's an integrative experience. It's an integration of your heart and your mind and your body, your direct experience in the moment, right? You know, so it makes sense to point to the heart, because bodhicitta actually, I think, in a way, well, not in a way, but it lives in the body, right?
Yeah. There's also that misconception that spiritual practices and Buddhist spiritual practices in particular might be about some idea of transcendence.
Yes.
And what I love about bodhicitta is that it is not at all about transcending your experience. It's about getting right in there with it, mm-hmm. when it's gross and painful and raw or whatever's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Which that speaks to you about that whole difference between concept and experience. Mm-hmm. So the conceptual idea of it, you can do the literal translation, awakened heart, mind, that kind of thing. How was it described to you the first time? Do you remember like the first time that you heard?
I do. Yeah. Cause it was, you know, I mean, I studied contemplative psych and psychology at Naropa. And so there's a lot of terms, and within bodhicitta, there were a lot of terms within that, like the basic goodness, the heart of sadness and joy, the Maitri. There were a lot of terms that got thrown into what bodhicitta is. So it was bodhicitta was a foundational place where all of these other things kind of sprung from. So there were a lot of concepts in that to unpack, really, because it's an all-encompassing experience and space. So, you know, the way it was described to me, I remember there's that quote, like, and I remember thinking at the beginning, like, why would anybody do this? You know, it's like that feather across the hand feels like a blade. Like, it's so tender. It's a tender, tender, vulnerable spot. And again, when I first started practicing, it was in a very different place in my life. You know, that vulnerability, I was like, what? You know, why? It was so counterintuitive. It's like, no, you're supposed to run from pain. You're not supposed to like lean into that. And of course, you know, what he's talking about is that the spaciousness, that it's not personal, right? It's that you're just being with whatever is there, and the sadness and the joy come together, because when you experience the suffering, the flip side to that is that there's also the joy and there's the goodness in people as well. And both are always available at the same time. It's a non-dual experience in that way. So that was kind of how it was introduced to me. And that basic goodness piece, of course, in Shambhala was really important, of like, in that place, everybody's whole and sane and healthy, right? And there's an inherent kindness, loving kindness in that place, that Maitri. So it's tender and it's soft. That's how it was introduced to me, was, but it's also fierce in the tenderness and softness. So a lot of words, right? And that's where it's always like, you can say these words, but really it's more about the felt experience of it.
Mm-hmm. And I find all of the different words so helpful for not locking down around a concept and thinking I understand it.
Right.
Because you know, every time there's another definition, I'm like, oh, okay. I'll add that to the heap.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Well, and that's where, you know, I think the practice, at least how, you know, I think everybody has there's like many different practices that are taught to get there. And I think we all develop our own relationship with it, but it really comes back to the breath in the moment and getting out of our own way to really feel it, you know? So,
yeah. And that Buddhism doesn't have a monopoly on it, right? Like bodhicitta is just the word as we learn it in Tibetan Buddhism specifically. But that there are this whole concept of that tenderness is, I guess, the way I understand it from reading some Christian texts, specifically reading stuff by Desmond Tutu, is mm-hmm. the willingness to bear witness.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And to show up for the suffering of the world in the way that, you know, like Jesus Christ did.
Yeah, without agenda, without expectation, with that humanity, that's a word that comes up to me a lot, is the humanity of it all. And this is the thing, I think, in again, in our culture, we tend to compartmentalize, right? Where it's like, oh, the suffering. So we'll focus on the pain. But within the pain and within the suffering, there's also health, and there's always resiliency if you allow the space to be with it. It's like the Mr. Rogers quote of like, you know, there's always helpers, look for the helpers, right? Mm-hmm. You know, so you can, you know, you drop in and you witness the suffering. And then also even in the witnessing of the suffering, that is health. And yeah. So it's there, and it's, it, yeah, Buddhism certainly doesn't have the monopoly on this. I think this is like a birthright. This is like what we, I think this is what we all come in with. We come in with this basic goodness and with this spaciousness in a way. And then through many causes and conditions, you know, we have many different coping mechanisms that we kind of cover it up. And the practice is to actually, again, uncover to that core of like, oh, wait, hey, here I am, right? And not in a personal here I am, but in a being sense of here I am.
Yeah, it's that tenderness that you were talking about earlier. You're saying like the tender quality of it, mm-hmm. and understanding that tender quality, if you don't have the tools to engage with that or the support to engage with that, you do cover it up. That's the first thing you run to do. Mm-hmm. You're like, oh, my tender beating little heart. So the space aspect of it is something that has actually been kind of up for me recently. Because when I first learned about bodhicitta, I learned about it from the story that Anupama tells all the time about how Trogom Trungpa, in order to get people to understand it, would share the story about being up in a temple or something like that, where he was up quite high, looking down on the street, and he could see some young boys who were throwing stones at a puppy and stoning it to death. And how his heart just broke for the whole situation. And the description is that his heart broke not just for the suffering of the puppy, but also the suffering of the boys who could cause that kind of harm. Like, what aspect of themselves are they blocking off so that they could cause that kind of harm to another being? So I always thought, like, okay, so there's that brokenheartedness and that suffering aspect that you're talking about. But recently, the spaciousness has been something that I've heard more and more coming out in conversations I'm having, where mm-hmm. people are like, right, because it's connecting with the emptiness side of things. And that is a lot more of a Buddhist specific thing.
Mm-hmm. and it's interesting. Yeah, because I mean, you can, again, to put in words and concept into it, right? There's equanimity in that space. Mm-hmm. It's not like the tenderness is reserved just for what you agree with or don't agree with, or, you know, again, it's not personal, right? Mm-hmm. It's not a personal space, right? It's a very interconnected space. And gosh, there was a point that I was kind of going, it's funny, I was having a really direct felt sense in that story. And then I went to concept and then lost the thread, isn't that? And, you know, and that's actually, I think, a good example of how we pop out of it, right? You know, I was like really feeling that equanimity of that story, and it was tender. And that's what you said, the emptiness of it, right? And for a long time in Buddhism, I was like, emptiness, like I was thinking it was like this transcendent thing. But at a certain point in my practice, I started experiencing emptiness is actually fullness. Mm-hmm. It's actually everything. And that's the equanimity. It's everything. It's not nothing. It's everything. Like, all interdependent, interconnected, leaning on one another, constantly having impact on one another, right? Dropping into that space and bearing that witness and being in that vulnerability is an action, right? And that's why bodhicitta is, I believe, you know, the foundation of all compassionate action.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So there's two directions that I want to go with this. I really like what you're saying about fullness. And we'll come back to that. But mm-hmm. first, you've now said compassion in action. So
drum roll.
As stated at the beginning, how right. important it is to understand that the definition is not inherent in the word, and that how people understand a word can be really personal. So let's define compassion as you and I are going to speak about it, because mm-hmm. it's pretty central to bodhicitta.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and this is where I'm going to just, you know, it's very humbling to do an interview like this, because there's way wiser people that have spoken about this. So I'm going to pull from that, right? You know, it's, I like the way Trungpa talks about idiot compassion versus compassion. I think, and again, you know, coming from my cultural context here in America, you know, we think of a compassion as like sympathy or empathy, even of, oh, poor you, or, oh, I feel you, I got it, right? You know, and while there can be components of those in compassion, the way I define compassion is it is more about what we're talking about, that tender heart and the understanding and the equanimity. And it's also fierce. It's also strong. It's Roshi Halifax. I know you and I had a conversation about this recently, you know, strong back, soft front. It's not about enabling. It's about standing a ground, but also not polarizing, right? And that's one thing that's happening in America right now. We're polarizing so much, and there has to be some kind of ground of connectivity and humanity in that. And, mm-hmm. and that's the compassion piece for me is, you know, Jesus, I can love the sinner, hate the sin.
Yeah. And I think to take it a bit, like, just to flesh this out a bit from my view of it, is that empathy is part of compassion. Mm-hmm. But like what you were saying about all the components, like the equanimity and all of that as well. So then the wisdom part of compassion as well, when I'm speaking about it, is what we were saying, and now we can come back to the fullness, is seeing the fullness of the situation. So mm-hmm. for me, my compassion practice is about encompassing the humanity of everyone involved in a situation and seeing it from the point of view of the suffering happening kind of thing, right? So like when I see someone expressing hatred, I don't see them as someone who's winning at life. I see that as someone who's in a lot of pain. And so the compassion piece is being able to connect with them as a fellow human being, mm-hmm. even while disagreeing with them and working to direct them elsewhere.
Absolutely.
If that's possible.
Absolutely. 100%.
Yeah. Also on the fullness thing, because of course we're talking a lot about that suffering aspect and the tenderness. And so people could be like, yeah, this does sound really uncomfortable. Why would I want to connect with all that?
Exactly. What's in it for me? What's the benefit?
So I'm going to use an example from Elizabeth Mathis Namgal.
Yes.
She talks about bearing witness, which to me, I think is like a key component of this bodhicitta, is that seeing the fullness of things. And she tells a story about bearing witness to beauty, where she went walking for a very long time through lots of snow in snowshoes, very great distance in the middle of winter, to get to a glacier lake that's like really, really remote. So lots of effort to get to this place. And it's pristine, and like the sunlight glinting off the snow, and there's this frozen waterfall that's the most brilliant turquoise she's ever seen in her life. And she becomes agitated. She gets mm-hmm. this like it's too much to bear. Mm-hmm. Until she then takes that moment to offer it. So she offers that experience, which again, that's a Buddhist practice. There mm-hmm. is something really beautiful in just the sense of like offering it. So you're not trying to contain it or grasp it. Mm-hmm. And then that brings her back to that place of bodhicitta, that tenderness, that openness to all things. Because there's that overwhelm, and the experience of overwhelm, whether it's because we're faced with suffering or because we're faced with great beauty, mm-hmm. can be the same thing.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, and this is where I think this concept of it's not personal. And that's hard, right? Because everything's subjective. We're running it through our bodies and our filters. And that's why for myself, a phrase I use is get out of the way. Like I, Jen Harkness, cannot hold everything in my system myself. That is impossible. You know, certainly I've attempted it, and it just creates like a ton of neurosis, right? And agitation and depression and it's really that place of not grasping, not rejecting, and not numbing out, and just getting getting bigger, tapping into something bigger than myself. However that works for somebody. I mean, I think in bodhicitta, we talk about like the absolute space of it. And I think over the years, I've kind of worked with that in myself of like, it's timeless. It's not even about now. It's timeless. This is like beyond time, beyond space. This is like all of it from the Big Bang to now. And if I can rest, if I can allow my system, my nervous system, my body to rest into that knowing of the bigness, the vastness of everything, right? Then it's not so personal, you know? And then my personal system can relax into that. And then I am more spacious then to be with the experience. But if I'm taking it personal, you know, my nervous system is going to get excited in some way. And then it's not as workable. Then it becomes personal again. Hopefully that makes a little bit of sense. I tend to, you know, because I'm a therapist, I think a lot about the nervous system and all of this too, because a lot of this is very felt sense, sensory based, which that's really about nervous system activation on a very foundational human level. So that's what we're working with in a lot of ways, which is very counterintuitive, right?
Well, and especially in Western culture, where so much emphasis is placed on knowledge and knowing and a very like the brain mm-hmm. rules all sort of thing, instead of realizing actually that there's a constant relationship between all parts of your physical being and a constant relationship between all parts of your physical being and everything outside of that, which mm-hmm. then is arguably not outside of that. Like,
and this is what's so beautiful is, I mean, you know, it's, and this is where the mind and the heart come to that integrative process, because you're using the mind as this brilliant, brilliant tool that it is to actually learn to rest and focus on the direct felt sense in the moment, and to learn to rest and focus on the space rather than rest, well, not rest, but rather than focus on the million other things that our minds want to do, right?
Yeah. Instead of getting focused on the concepts. So I think there's a piece there, and that's something that I notice in the way that people talk about mind versus brain and the way that mind gets used in Buddhist communities in particular. Mm. Yeah. Which, you know, it kind of circles back to when we were defining bodhicitta at the very beginning in the like the literal sense of that heart mind and mind being something so much bigger than what's in your head.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. That does tend to go off into a topic of like consciousness. what is consciousness and all of that. But yeah, but I like that, you know, mind, yes, mind being bigger than just like my brain and my psychology, right? It's just like the difference between Buddhist ego and psychological ego, you know, psychological ego being more like personality. And Buddhist ego certainly encompasses some of that personality, but is, to my understanding, more about that grasping, aversion, or numbing out, right? You know, like as soon as that starts to happen, it's ego. The words do get confusing in the West, I think, because psychology, which is definitely a prevalent viewpoint of the time, and Buddhism use a lot of the same words, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And I think the ego point, just using what you've already said before, is about the fact that like ego is when you make it personal, when your suffering is like special.
Right. And bodhicitta is like, no, it's not special. It's like totally just like par for the course. Like this is being human.
This is being human. And then the same thing goes for all of like the magical experiences. When you think like, I deserve this, I've earned this. It's like, no, you're just human. This is just part of living.
Right. Exactly. A few minutes ago, it was like, so what, you know, why do this? You know, what's the motivation? And certainly, you know, I know in your interviews, you always kind of ask people how they come to their path of awakening, no matter what that path is. And so everybody has their own individual answer. But really, I think bodhicitta and compassionate action and really focusing on basic goodness, the health and resiliency in there, it makes us happier overall, happier in that content way, in that way that we can fearlessly, vulnerably tolerate our experience in a way that is not so reactive, and we have more choice and response.
Yeah. Could you provide an example from your own life of how bodhicitta has played out?
Oh, man. That's a good question. It's interesting. I think it plays out all the time these days, especially in the work that I do. I think that's where, that's my main practice and focus of it is, you know, I'm a therapist. I sit with people talking about intense suffering often. I also talk with people about intense joy as well. And so being able to take a breath and kind of get out of the way, get my agenda out of the way, my stories out of the way, you know, and again, not that they're not still there. I just kind of have practiced enough that I can kind of put them to the side and watch them, but not attach to them and be in that spaciousness with a person and allow it to unfold. There's a lot of allowing, right? Just allowing it to unfold the way it needs to, allow the conversation to unfold the way it needs to. And for me, one of the main practices in that, which you and I mentioned in the last interview we did, is then Tonglen. So bodhicitta and Tonglen kind of almost go hand in hand for me.
Yeah.
It's become such a on the spot, like, okay, here I am, and breathing in the suffering and breathing out all the yummy stuff. And they're both here right now in this moment happening. And I'm not going to reject or grasp any of it. And I'm going to show up and see what happens. And that's, I know it's not like maybe a pointed specific example, but that is a day-to-day practice that anybody has available at any time, really. So it's quite lovely. And I think what it's done for me overall is expanded my capacity to be alive. I feel more alive, which is a really beautiful thing, even in the excruciating pain of that sometimes, because right beside it is the beauty of it as well. And so allowing myself to feel the suffering has also allowed me to feel the exuberance of being in form as well.
That's really good. I was thinking actually the last instruction on Tonglen that I heard from Anipama, she said that you just have to remember that the in-breath is compassion and the out-breath is love.
Ooh, yeah.
I thought, wow. That's wow. And that's bodhicitta, right? It's that balance of love and compassion, you know, bearing with, being present, maintaining the equanimity and having an open-heartedness to the fullness of everything.
Yeah. Well, and it's unconditional too. And I think that's where, you know, as soon as you asked me that question, I also immediately thought of the places where I struggle with bodhicitta. It's interesting because in the construct of being a therapist, it's easier for me to cultivate because I've learned to not have expectations. It's easier to be unconditional. But then, like, you know, in a romantic relationship or my family of origin relationships or friendships, you know, it starts to get sticky because there's there's expectations and, you know, and all that's human too, right? It's not to put that down or judge that. I actually am saying it with a smile because I think that is a big part of the practice, you know? So then can I bring that spaciousness into those relationships where there's more dependence? And that is really tough, which is why, you know, Trungpa, like relationships, the fast track to enlightenment, right? You're going to see all the edges where, oh, I'm not so spacious there.
You know? Yeah. There's that teaching that he has that when you think that you've achieved some sort of spiritual realization, go spend a week with your family.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. Yep.
Yeah. But how's that experience been? Because I know for me, that has been a huge part of my understanding. Like when you said earlier about the difference between the concepts and the actual experience, is like that experientially, I have learned the most about bodhicitta and the quality of it from the work I've done around those people who are like there and you've got all those habits with them. And it's like, I've known you my entire life, mom, and you still irritate me.
Exactly.
Which I say with the greatest love and affection, because my mom and I, like, we talk about a lot of this stuff and it's been great because I can actually share with her how my practice has influenced our relationship. We can have that conversation. And that's because of bodhicitta. Like, I couldn't have done that 10 years ago.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, because I mean, especially family of origin, it's like, it's so patterned. Because again, therapist, kind of a brain geek, I think about how our brains, so, you know, the difference between mind and brain, but they go together in a lot of ways. So brains are very habitual, right? And so we have all these habits, like the opposite of bodhicitta's habitual mind, right? You know, and so there's all these edges to watch the habits come up. And that's where the compassion is, right? Like everybody has these habits. Everybody has neurosis. This is not special to me, to you, to anybody. We've all got it. And so I think part of bodhicitta, part of the practice is to find the places where you naturally can drop into that spaciousness, right? I think a lot of people, if they really think about it, they've had this experience of bodhicitta. Maybe they haven't called it that, but there's been like a census, maybe you took a long hike or you held a baby or, you know, like these moments of sadness and joy coming together and humanity. And you find those and then you cultivate them, right? You practice to where then when you go home to your mom and your habitual response comes up and you're like, right? You can go, oh, wait, there it is. There's the grasping. And can I take a breath? Can I bring some of that spaciousness into now? And trusting that process, because I do think it's a process that we have to, that's why it's called practice. I mean, we're literally making a new habit in our entire being, body, mind, spirit, all of it, to where hopefully, yeah, then you get to have those conversations and allow it to shift and change and grow. You can't force change in a lot of ways. I think that's also counterintuitive in the West. We think like we're going to fix it, right? Yeah. You know? And as soon as you have that energy around it, there's constriction and then it's not as workable. There has to be some space and allowance of like, oh yeah, okay, here's this thing, here's this feeling. And it's not until you can name it and accept it that you can look at it and maybe find a different way.
Yeah. Well, and then that's the awake quality, right? Bodhi, the awake aspect of the whole thing. And you said at the very beginning about prajna, which again, another one of those words we could spend an entire episode talking about, but let's just say for now, wisdom.
Right. Yeah.
So that's the wisdom that comes out of the whole thing. And then you just learn to respond. You said that earlier. And I think that is like, there's such a difference between saying, I'm going to learn how to respond to a situation versus I'm going to learn how to fix a situation.
Yeah. Fixing has, it has a lot of, especially when it comes to people, right? It has an aggression behind it. It denotes that there's something wrong, which is one of the most revolutionary things in Buddhism to me. I think this is one of the reasons that I practice Buddhism, besides it just makes a lot of sense to me, is basic goodness. Like that notion, because I come from Christianity and there's beautiful parts of Christianity, absolutely, that I still hold dear. But that notion of like original sin and sin, like there's something wrong that you have to correct, right? And Buddhism really comes in with, nah, you know, you got this. Like you're totally whole and healthy and sane and it's all good in there. And then, you know, all this suffering really comes from you trying to protect yourself,
which is a resist.
Or resist. Well, I think resistance is a kind of protection.
Yeah, yeah, it is, right. Because it's that trying to get away from whatever it is. I always like, and I don't know if it's actually attributed to anyone or if it's just one of those things that gets said that's out there, but I really like the statement, suffering is not a punishment and happiness is not a reward.
Yeah.
Which on the surface, I can hear that and I'd be like, yeah, totally. But then I notice my mind just grasp onto that. Yeah. When I'm suffering, I feel like I'm being punished or I've done something wrong. And therefore I need to fix, I need to like resist what's going on. Or I need to justify like, no, I don't deserve to suffer because I'm a good person. Like, wait, a lot of concept in that statement.
Well, and it's interesting because as you were saying that, like I actually, whenever I hear that dilemma, like I actually go to bodhicitta very quickly because that's just so human.
Yeah.
Right? It's so exquisitely, tenderly human. That is just like a knee-jerk response that humans have, right? And the thing about Buddhism, I think, is so revolutionary is it's very counterintuitive to what our, again, that very primal reaction is. It's really trying to relax into a different part of our being and our brains and not be in that kind of fight, flight, freeze, faint stuff and be able to regulate, have some pause. Not that you know, you're not rejecting that experience either, but you're pausing and you're breathing and you're regulating and kind of building this other response system within your body and your mind to be able to have a different kind of experience. So it's pretty revolutionary if you think about it.
It totally is. It totally is. So what are the resources or the supports or like some of the teachings on bodhicitta that you have found most useful in your life?
Oh boy. so many, I'm so eclectic. I know when you and I have conversations, certainly there's so much out there. I think anything Pema Chodron, right? Of course. But you know, honestly, Trungpa, a lot of his stuff has been very helpful in that. I really like Elizabeth, is it Mattis or Mathis Namgyal?
Mattis Namgyal.
Thank you. Yeah. I mean, I think those are kind of the ones that I currently think of and turn to as far as like references, like reference points.
And as for practices, I mean, you've said Tonglen, obviously, and I think that is the primary practice. Is there a specific resource for Tonglen that you think is really good or a specific teacher? And are there any other practices that you think are really helpful?
You know, again, I have to kind of go to my roots, which is at Naropa. So it's really Trungpa and Pema Chodron are the two that I am most familiar with. And kind of that's who I go back to over and over and over again. Actually, based off of this interview, it's very helpful because I was like, I'm going to go back and like reread and re-listen to all the stuff that I haven't in a while, right? Because there's not like an endpoint to this journey where we're constantly evolving and constantly learning to understand it in new ways. And you know, I think for a lot of us, we're top down processors, meaning like, you know, we kind of get it conceptually and then over time we're learning to digest it and embody it. And so, I feel a lot of curiosity about, where are the edges I need to grow now? So I think I'm going to go back to those resources. But another thing I've been really within all of this personally, really big on lately is gratitude. Which I think gratitude is actually a huge part of basic goodness of like the basic stuff. You know, like if you're cold and you get a blanket, the basic goodness of that, of just like, oh, a blanket and now I'm warm. This mm-hmm. very simple, basic human, you pass a person on the street. Lately, I've been really trying to make eye contact with everybody and just smile and just see them as much as I can and have a feeling of gratitude, like, hey, we're sharing the planet, you know, and like just these small practices on a daily basis, I think are part of bodhicitta. You know, it's slightly different, but I think it ties in of like, can I be present to the goodness that's here now? I think particularly because in a lot of our practices and brains, it's the suffering can get heavy. You know, obviously when I'm in a place of like true bodhicitta, that's okay. But also there's sticky edges in me all over the place. And so I'll be like, oh, that's so heavy. This is so hard. And so I think a part of cultivating bodhicitta is also really having a focus on the basic goodness in the day-to-day too. So that's been, I think right now, my focus and practice of just the moment to moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the fact that it is an ongoing, you said before, it's a process.
Oh, gosh. Yeah.
There's not a switch.
No. Which is why it's always, you know, the giggling, you know, during our talk today is so lovely. Because I think it's an assumption, but I think we know each other well enough. It's like, you know, we're talking about all this and these words and fully knowing that we are so in process with it. Like, I am so in process with all of this. It's like, whew. It's kind of, it's fun to talk about and also, again, humbling, like, oh, okay, I still don't know as well. Yeah. And that's
we're not experts.
No.
I have so many people when I invite them to be on the show, they're like, I'm not an expert. I'm like, that's the point. I want people to understand no one's really an expert.
Yeah. But you know, but that's an important part of the process of the practice, don't you think?
Mm-hmm.
like being able to say, okay, we're human, we're in process. Like, actually, nobody's got this.
Yeah. Some people are just a little further ahead on the road, but they also are completely lost in other ways.
Right. Because that's, again, that's the humanness. And that's why I always love Pema when she says, you know, I'm a horrible meditator. And I'm like, oh, I love that so much, you know, because it's like the humanity of it, right? Like, we're all just doing the best we can. And that's part of that Maitri and that basic goodness too. And just allowing the space for it all to happen. Right.
Yeah. And knowing that doing the best we can, this is a recent thing I've heard from Angel Kyoto Williams, is that doing the best we can doesn't mean that we're not also being better.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, that's why we practice, right? And that's where I guess, you know, as we're kind of coming towards the end here, that I find incredibly helpful is just not alone ever in any of this, never alone, and always can dedicate the merit. And so, you know, oddly, I think a lot of us do like that story with Elizabeth up at the glacier. You know, it's like, I think a lot of us actually struggle with happiness too. Like, it's to be in beauty and awe, it can be really overwhelming. And so, you know, dedicating the merit of that and having mudita, that sympathetic joy of like, all right, like, I feel so grateful and alive to have this experience and I want to share it with the world. And that, it's just such a beautiful sentiment that, again, helps us to get out of that personalization, which I think, whew, talk about suffering. That's really the root of it, right? Making everything so personal, but also human.
So human. Fantastic. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Thank you, Kate. This was great.
It's fantastic. And it worked out okay. I don't think that not having notes in any way damaged this.
It was great. Yeah. I enjoyed it a lot. It's lovely.
Jennifer Harkness is a licensed mental health counselor and registered art therapist based in Seattle, Washington. She was on Everything Is Workable before to speak about the noble practice of self-care. It's a great episode. You can give a search for it in iTunes or on Google Play. For more detailed information about Jennifer's work in the world or to connect with her, visit CourageousHeartHealing.com. To learn more about my work in the world, visit CaitlinSCHatch.com. Along with more episodes of Everything Is Workable, you can find my blog, books, and art. You can also become a patron or leave a tip to help support the things that I do. This episode of Everything Is Workable was made possible through the patronage of Gretchen Wagner, Julian and Shannon Hatch, Winita Budgen, and Margaret Prescott, among others. Thank you to Tejai Moore of More Music for the original theme song.